Committee on Business and Labor will come to order for first an organizational meeting. Chair Doherty is sick today. She's sorry she can't be here. In the meantime, Vice Chair Kennemer and I are staging a coup and might declare ourselves chair for life. That started,
or at least until the speaker.
Exactly. Until Ramona's probably on her way now. So we're going to go through. Today is going to look like, first we have to have an organizational meeting to adopt the committee rules. Then we're going to have some invited testimony. It should last in total about an hour, half hour each for two different panels. Then we're going to move on to two bills, the one of which, House Bill 4120, we're actually planning to move today. That's the Lipke family is going to be down on Thursday, and we normally try to give a hearing before we move a bill, but under these circumstances, we have to move it today, and appreciate Jan's work on getting that ready to go. So having said that, I'm going to go ahead and open the organizational meeting for adoption of committee rules. Vice Chair Kennemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Representative Kennemer moves to adopt the proposed committee rules. Is there any discussion? Perhaps, Jan, would you be able to tell us if there are any changes in these rules that we should be aware of?
I just want to point out that compared to the long session, the notice requirements are different. During the short session, the committee will have to give 48 hours notice for the first public hearing on a House bill. After that, it's 24 hours. But all work sessions are post and go. So as long as we've posted it outside, the chair can hold a work session. That is really the only difference. There's a shorter time frame for filing a minority report compared to the long session. You have to give notice at the meeting or by 5 o'clock the day of the meeting, and then 24 hours you have to turn around and have the amendment back from council. So those are the shorter timelines for the short session.
Great. So it's like the long session, shorter notice periods. It's like the end of session at the beginning of session.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Representative Widener.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, you could post something 5 minutes before committee and we're good to go on it and nobody's seen it or had a chance to look over it?
That's correct. For work sessions, it's post and go.
End of session at the beginning of session. Any further discussion? Any additional questions? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bagan?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
No.
Representative Bolby?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Excused.
Representative Weiser?
No.
Vice Chair Cameron?
Aye.
Chair Barton?
Aye. Motion passes and the rules are adopted. We are going to close the organizational meeting and we are going to open an informational meeting on pay equality in Oregon. And we have four people today, but we're going to stay. First two, I'd like to invite up Senator Edwards, who used to be on this committee. Welcome home, Senator. As well as Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian. Thanks for driving down, Commissioner.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state senator in Eugene and Junction City. And I will be very brief in just telling you a little bit about how we ended up with this report on pay inequality in Oregon. In 2012, I opened up the newspaper one fine morning and read the annual statistics about wage inequality in the United States. And I remember thinking to myself at that time, man, this report, this annual number comes out every single year. And I've never seen legislation on it. I mean, you know, what? I'm sure it's a really complex problem, but I would like to know more about what can be done to shrink the gap in wages between men and women, and also particularly minorities. And so I went to our labor commissioner, Commissioner Avakian and asked him, what's the Bureau of Labor and Industries doing about this? Do you have any particular ideas? And we got to talking, and we thought that commissioning a study would be a really good way to start an analysis of the problem and to hopefully kickstart some potential legislative solutions to the issue. So before us today, in the 2013 legislative session, we had Senate Bill 744, which commissioned the Oregon Council on Civil Rights to do the study and present the findings to this legislative session. So they're here today. There are a number of statistics, some of them quite alarming, and some which I think will serve as a wake-up call for members of this legislative body. And I hope to see some good pieces of legislation advance in the next legislative session as a result of the work they've done thus far. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for inviting us here today. I'm Brad Avakian, Commissioner of Labor and Industries. And I also want to thank Senator Edwards and this body for passing Senate Bill 744 last session, which is the vehicle that led to this presentation today. You've shown great interest in the issue of pay inequality, and I'm grateful for that. In a moment, you're going to hear from Sunny Pettit, who chairs the Oregon Council on Civil Rights, NOVA newcomer, who is a member, and they're going to present the recommendations to you. What they're showing you is the compilation of some terrific work over the last 2 years by the Council on Civil Rights as they studied the reasons for pay inequality and then came up with recommendations to myself, the Bureau of Labor Industries, and all of you on what they believe would eventually eliminate wage gaps in Oregon. The Council on Civil Rights exists in order to advise me and the Bureau, all of you, any other elected officials, on any important matter regarding the progress of civil rights in the state. And pay inequality was the first issue that they chose to take up a couple years ago. What you'll see in their presentation and in the report as you read it deeper are several things. One, that there's no single overarching solution to pay inequality, but that these recommendations show there are some things that we can do about it. And then lastly, that I thought was of significance, is this is not just an enforcement effort. The Bureau will continue to enforce the laws against people who intentionally discriminate. But we've had laws on the books since the 50s regarding pay inequality. These recommendations go beyond just enforcing the law and into how we shift the culture, the business culture in Oregon, voluntarily, in many respects, to adopt more family-friendly policies that achieve equality on the job. And with that, unless you've got any questions of me, I want to thank you once again for inviting us, and I'll leave it to the council to make the presentation.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, because there's a lot of issues that I have on this. Mr. Avakian, and one of them is geographical area, because I'll have people come in and say, you know, in a minority community, the average income is $52,000 a year. Well, I live in a small community, and the average income per household in my community is $42,000 a year. So it's not a minority community by any means, but people choose to live out there so they can have privacy and different things like that, and away from industrial areas. And the thing I watch with income going up, it's where there is industry that's thriving, industries being built, and the thing I'm seeing in my communities, like we just had a paper mill that shut down a paper machine. Those are high income jobs that left. So the pay inequity I see happening more because lack of industrial jobs that we have in this community and higher end jobs for people to go work at. And I want to know, is that something that you push them hard to look into and do when they're doing these kind of studies? Because I think we overlook that a lot when we're doing these studies, and we're just trying to pit people against each other, because to me it's not about racial inequity or anything like that. It's about opportunities for people and creating those opportunities. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that and what you've ran into.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, you bring up a very important point with regard to the economies of families and the whole state, you know, statewide. There is no question that there are differences in the average wages of people depending on where they live in the state. In general, the rural areas have lower wages than the urban areas do. And I could not agree with you more that we need to be doing all we can to provide opportunity to a living wage job in every part of the state. I think that is one issue, and I think it's a separate issue as to, in any microeconomy, are women still earning on the average the same as the men, and are people of color still earning on par with white men? And I believe what you'll find is that those disparities exist everywhere, even in places that have a more depressed economy than the urban centers.
Any further questions of this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Again, Commissioner, thank you for driving down. Next, we will call up Sonny Pettit and Nova Newcomer. Come on up. You can go in any order you wish. Just remember to introduce yourself for the record.
Okay.
Welcome.
Please introduce your baby. She drove
down. Yeah. My name is Sonny Pettit, and I am chair of the Council of Civil Rights. And my baby is Mariette back there. She's 3.5 months old, and she's very excited to be here.
She is adorable. Glad you brought her. Just go ahead and pull that microphone right up.
And Sonny will be doing a presentation. My name is Nova Newcomer. I'm a member of the Oregon Council for Civil Rights and also a small business owner.
So first I wanted to say thank you so much for asking us to do this report, and we're really thrilled to be here and share the results with you this morning. This is after about 18 months of work. We looked at international, national, and state data and came up with all of these ideas, recommendation, and research. And I will get started. And this is also will be online, so that if you want to look over the presentation, you can see that there as well. Here we are at the beginning of how this came about. Thank you for the lights. So Oregon has been a leader in the past. In 1955, we passed the Equal Pay Act, and in 1963, the federal government came in and also passed one of these. One of the things that we have found is, though, there are still loopholes that need to be fixed. People will talk about, people will talk about whether or not this is real. Can you hear me?
Yes. Okay. If I could make a suggestion,
sure.
About 6 inches from the mic
tends to get
the best sound. Otherwise, we get this reverberating sound,
yeah.
and none of us hear exactly what you're saying.
That's perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you. So nationally, on average, women are earning about 77 cents per dollar for every dollar men earn. And minority women, especially African American and Latinas, are making significantly less. These are the wage gaps that women face over time. One of the things that we think about is how this compounds over a lifetime. So, you know, even immediately 1 year after college graduation, women are making 7% less. That over a lifetime, and we know that's not necessarily because of their education, because of what they're doing. It's just something that is making this occur. And over time, this compounds into retirement insecurity, economic insecurity, community insecurity. One of the things up here, we talk about the motherhood penalty. Obviously, this is something that's important to me. What we found is that women mothers will make 60 cents to every dollar a father makes. This is when we start looking at the differences in between different minority groups. And one of the things that you'll see, so I'll just say it here, for the median income, Latinas are making about 59 cents. Black women are 68 cents. White women are 80 cents here. Asian women are 87.6 cents. But one of the things that you'll see is that women, there is a significant piece that has to do with gender. So that in each of these categories, it is women that are making less money. People will say, well, what about women choosing different jobs? Is it about choice? So we looked at the four highest positions in Oregon, and what we found was that in these three areas, women occupy this number. They're still not a majority of workers in this area. In the one area where women do make up the majority, in health diagnosing and treatment practitioners, women are still making only 64 cents to every dollar of their male counterparts. So now we start looking at what are the causes. And first, I'll just say this. A recent study came out talking about breadwinners. Women breadwinners are now two-thirds of co- or single breadwinners of their family. Obviously, this underscores the issue of why it's important. If you put money in women's pockets, they're going to spend it in their communities. They're going to spend it on their children. And in some reports have actually called that it will cut poverty quite significantly. We believe there's a strong business case for closing the pay gap. From all of our research, it has shown that women are, or any kind of equal pay gap, that people will be spending that money in their communities. When you also have great talent recruitment and talent retaining, that's also important because you have great workers who are loyal, who care about your company, who care about the community, and are able to stay there and build stronger networks. The four main recommendations that we have are on outreach and awareness, education and training, employer incentives, and legislation and monitoring. Because not all of this can be done legislatively, we wanted to share with you the report of all of our findings, which I think really underscore the variety of things that that shows us what contributes to this. We started looking at technical assistance. We also looked at public service announcements and partnering with employers. One of the things that BOLI currently does right now is provide technical assistance to employers. They have $20,000 calls per year around questions that employers have. Well, how do we do this? How do we work on this? This is something that we think could be implemented within this system so that employers who might need to know a little bit more are able to ask a question. Public service announcements. There was a YouTube. It's on YouTube now. I don't know if any of you remember it. This Batgirl equal pay ad in the 70s. And one of the things that they do is they have Robin and Batman tied up, and there's a bomb that's going to go off, and Batgirl comes in and she says, "Well, you know, this is the right time for me to talk about equal pay because I'm not getting paid as much as Robin right now." But you know, kind of thinking about those things, is there something that we can do where we're really doing more outreach and awareness that this is an issue? We talk about education and training. Really building a pipeline of skilled workers, trying to start concentrating on things like more education, more STEM and technical skills training. Expanding opportunities in male-dominated fields and majors, creating more educational opportunities, and more supportive services for women and people of color. And then these are practices which help keep women in good jobs. Oops. Ah! I went back too fast. So hiring, promotion, and pay equity audits. This is something that has come up a lot. When a lot of times when businesses will hire somebody, you have a panel of people who are doing an interview so that you have a very good reason for hiring that person. But when you do the promotion, one of the things that we found is that if you can have some similar tools in order to measure that person's performance rather than having one person do it. So it's really bringing hiring practices into promotion practices as well. doing joint evaluations along the same lines as this. Paid family and medical leave. This is something in the United States, we're really one of the only a handful of countries in the world that does not have a federal paid leave act. Paid sick time and time off to participate in school activities. We think that expanding employment-related daycare assistance will be also very important. Oregon is the least affordable state when it comes to child care. The annual cost of child care for single-parent families is 61% of annual income. One of the things that we think, and I know, Representative Matthews, that you are well aware of this issue being in the field. And, of course, it's really important, too, that we have great child care facilities. But it is expensive, and how we can help parents is a way of expanding ERDC eligibility to 250% of the federal poverty level. One of the things I like to underscore at this point is to talk about what that federal poverty level is, because I don't think there very many people know what it is. I'm sure all of you do, but just for the people in the room, for a family of three, it's about $19,000 a year. And I'm sure many of you know that is extremely difficult on raising a family. I can't even imagine it. An Oregon Paycheck Fairness Act is another issue we think can really make a difference. It can close loopholes in the state's Equal Pay Act by adopting this. One of the things that it does is it says it provides negotiation skills for girls and women, better enforcement of existing protections, and it prohibits retaliation against employees who discuss wage information. I think that is probably one of the biggest pieces of this act. A right to request flexibility. This is similar to some federal efforts, but this is something that we think it's not that you would have to give flexible schedules or give predictable schedules, but it's a right to request it and not be retaliated against. And then an Oregon Fair Pay Act, which would require employers to provide equal pay for jobs that are comparable in skill, education, responsibilities, and working conditions. And then data collection. As you all know, the government and many other groups have been gathering this data for years and years. In fact, it's why we're able to give you this report, is it because it's coming from all of this data. And if you can't measure information, you can't really tell how it's getting better or how we can do better on it, and if it's making a difference. And so one of the things that we think would be very important to do is to improve our data collection. I guess I wanted to end with just saying that I think that Oregon really has a strong space. We've pioneered efforts before, and there are other great states that are doing this work. But I think we have the opportunity to also be a leader in this area. And I want to thank you all for believing in trying to understand the problem and trying to get to the root of how we can start making a difference at it today. So I'll take questions.
Four questions. Ms. Newcomer, do you want to...
I'm sorry?
Do you want to share any remarks before we go to questions?
Well, I think that I'd like to underscore what Sunny said, but also I really think that
the... at the beginning.
Would you like me to reintroduce myself?
It can't
hurt. Would that be helpful?
Okay.
You know what? So my name's Nova Newcomer. I'm a member of the Oregon Council for Civil Rights and a small business owner, and I think that for me, there are... my own personal experiences in the workforce, and then also running a business and understanding the importance of strong family wage jobs that create a stronger economy. And when you see marketing companies love to talk about how we need to speak to women because women make 85% of household decisions around purchases. Well, I'd like to see those women be able to make those purchases out in the economy. And so part of that is, affected by some of these recommendations that have been made in the report, which I think are very broad and looking at a number of factors that impact pay inequality.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Widener.
Yeah.
as you heard earlier, this is something that actually intrigues me. And one of the things you kind of touched on a little bit was education, the difference there and everything. I'm wondering, because you were seemed to focus on men and women, the pay inequality there. And the best scenario I have is the case with my wife and I. My wife has always chose to stay home with the kids and has not afforded me that ability to do so. I would have, with four boys, had more fun staying at home with them and letting her work a little bit more. But I'm wondering if that's a choice that you see with women, that they want to be home more with kids, so they take part-time jobs or don't work the long hours. Like for me, I go 7 days a week and have never seen a paycheck because my wife, she gets the paychecks and she takes care of everything and probably handles 95% of our household needs. So just because of my time commitment with work and things like that. So I'm wondering how much that has went into your study, looking at that demographic and the pay inequality between the men and the women.
Well, I think what we looked at was whether or not there is a gap, even when it's apples to apples. And so even if women and men have the exact same education and go into the same field, they are still making less.
I'm just wondering how much of that flows into the socioeconomic scale of their choices as a household.
Right.
Are they making less because they choose to, or because they don't want to put in the hours that someone else is doing, or is it they're both equal? They're doing 80 to 100 hours a week in their job scale?
I think that's a really important question, and certainly that is the reality of some families. But with two-thirds of breadwinners being women, I think that the gap that can be addressed through looking at employment practices, looking at education training, looking at technical assistance for businesses to understand the issue better. You're looking at making an impact on 67% of wage earners. Now, that is not to say that obviously the way you've described what your wife does in your home is very valued work, and she seems extremely talented. And certainly there are some things for her economically that, for your family, you guys have made that choice, and that certainly is a valid choice to make. But when you look at apples to apples, the wage gap exists. And so certainly every family looks a little bit differently. But it's important that we're not talking about people's choices making a difference on the wage gap. We're talking about there are some system structural issues that could really help and make a difference and get money back into people's wallets to make purchasing decisions.
I think the other piece to add in this is that for fathers also that end up staying home, right, it makes a difference communities for the entire community as well.
If I may follow up. Just to
briefly. Yeah, we're watching it run a short on time. Go ahead, Representative.
My concern is that we don't create a situation where it gets worse for women when we start saying mandatory time off for child leave, all these other things. It better be for both sides of the aisle, because if you just do it for women, now people aren't going to want to hire women because, oh, shoot, I got to give them an extra 5 days off that I wouldn't if I hired a man. Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at these things, those are things we need to take into consideration very seriously when we're doing this.
Absolutely.
Any further questions for this panel? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Excuse me. You touched on it, but I didn't get a chance to absorb it. But how does one determine comparable work? What goes into that determination?
Comparable work. One of the things that we talk about is if they have the same sort of job duties. So if they are doing, in effect, the same job, but they might have a different category. So they may be doing the same, trying to think of a good example, which would be maybe acting as an administrative assistant or versus where they're doing very much of the same as an office manager. And they might be doing exactly the same job duties, but they, because they would be in different categories, they wouldn't be considered having to have the same fall under the same pay piece.
This is especially important in lower wage work, like cleaning, for example, where you might have, you know, cleaning on a factory floor, which the job skills would be very similar to cleaning at night in the offices upstairs. Those are the kinds of things where you can see a wage gap on jobs that are very similar. And that's just one example, but it's a very, especially when you're talking about low wage workers, where this wage gap really makes a difference for families.
Further questions, Representative?
Well, I'm just thinking back to, for instance, out on a construction job where a laborer is carrying some, you know, 2x4s, and then they turn around and carry the rebar, and suddenly now they're in a wage classification. They're earning $10 more an hour or more just because they're handling this material rather than this material. I don't know. It seems like it would be very hard to actually to measure one for one, and I'm just wondering what how you did it, but it sounds like it's even confusing to you.
There are a lot of variables to control for.
It's hard
in a study like this.
And this data is not new data. We're presenting it newly because the legislature asked for it. This data has been being collected over 30 years, and the conclusions around the wage gap have not changed. They certainly Senator Edwards underscored that with the fact that he kept seeing it come up and not much done on it. And I think that that's what the point of this report is, and the point of the council is to provide this data to you, provide some recommendations, and, you know, maybe there is some more definition around how you as a legislature will take these findings and implement them to reduce the wage gap.
Representative Freeman, do you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Chair Barton, and thank you for being here. I appreciate your efforts in this. And unlike Representative Widener, my wife has always worked outside the home, and she's always made more money than me, but I'm come to terms with that because she's a lot smarter than I am. My question is, and I think this is implied in your presentation, but we've dealt with some equity things here before, and it's not always quite as clear as we want it to be. I'm assuming your intent is to bring everybody up to the high level, not bring the top down and meet somewhere in the middle?
I hope so.
Well, that sounds kind of funny, but when you talk about equity, it can be several things. It can be, you know, let's take the high wage earners down and bring the low up and make it equitable.
And I think mostly what we're trying to do is just to make sure that people aren't being underpaid for doing the same kind of work.
I assume that's what you were getting at. It wasn't super clear in the presentation, so thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, final questions. Let's go Representative Thompson and Representative Holby. We've got about 3 minutes left.
It occurs to me that maybe we're putting the emphasis in the wrong place. We can collect data on disparities between men and women all day, but it doesn't answer the question of how we got there. My wife is a petroleum geologist, and she had precious few female colleagues in most of her classes, and pursued that career until she found out that rural Saudi Arabia is not where you want to be as a woman geologist for some other reasons. But what is the separator that determines that? I'm not aware of any community college or university that deliberately in any way restricts women going into math, science, engineering, and those sorts of things. So the problem is they're not arriving at the door. Now, does it start when they're 7 years old, 8 years old, 10 years old? Where does it start, and how do we? Where's that separation? Because somewhere there's a separation. And as a botanist, it was the same thing. You didn't find very many women in botany, although more than you did in engineering. Mm-hmm. And so there is a natural or unnatural separation somewhere prior to professional training that is delivering this problem to us, and we need to find out how to interrupt that.
And I think that's a really interesting point, but there are also many, many studies where even within those exact same fields of, you know, very, very trained medical doctors or scientists, women are still making at the same job less money. And so I think that you raise a good point, and that's why we do think it's important to do more skills training, especially for women, to get more women and minorities into those fields. But again, I think the data shows that even within those high-paying jobs, there is still a difference.
Representative Holmey, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you. I'm just curious if you, you'd mentioned that we needed to do a better job of collecting data. So that prompts me to ask the question, have you identified some of the obstacles to obtaining the data that from income data to employment data and, you know, all of the above? So does your study look at those obstacles and make recommendations on that?
I think one of the things, it's a best practice as well. It's something that we know just makes a difference. I'm trying to find the right page for you. But I think that it's something that we know makes a difference. So if we do pass a law, can we make sure that we are, hold on. Oh, I won't tell you to hold on, though. If we do pass a law, can we make sure that we are tracking it to make sure that that information going forward is, that we are making a difference, that it is doing the right thing?
Just to add to that, the recommendations that we made included the data collection because we so strongly believe that the census issue has been something that's been talked about for 30 years and has been in existence for much longer. We wanted to make sure that if this legislature, hopefully this one or future ones, puts some of these things into place, and also if businesses put these things into place, we want to make sure that that there's an accountability around this effort and that the wage gap does get decreased and that money does end up flowing back to families and into communities. We want to see that actually happen. And so I think that there are always going to be some issues and obstacles to data collection. I think that it's important to make that reasonable. And I think that that's something that needs to be looked at. But the primary reason for that specific recommendation was around making sure that that these efforts were about making a difference in our communities.
Thank you guys for your work. Thank you to Senator Edwards and Commissioner Avakian for teeing this issue up and your presentation. It's a big issue. It's been around for a long time, and we'll see if we can't distill this issue into some legislation that
may I share one final comment?
2015. Yes, of course.
So one thing that I always do, I have two young kids, and so oftentimes my husband and I want to try to get out for an evening just to maintain our sanity. And I have babysitters who come in, and they're mostly girls, and they, 15-year-old girls who are looking to have their first chance at employment. As a society, their work is obviously very valued from, at the family level. But when I asked them what their rate was, they said, just $10 for the night. And I said, okay, well, what does that mean? Does that mean I can be gone the whole night? Or does that mean that I can, that's a couple of hours? And, they didn't know the answer to that. And so I think that we have some recommendations around negotiation and skills training. But, when those first jobs are already at a 7% decrease, when the 7% wage gap already exists for equal work, anyone who runs a business knows that that salary actually dictates future salary and future earnings. And when you see that start to widen over time, you can see that person's value, the internal value is decreased. This is an issue that crosses across ethnicities and racial groups, and it hits women specifically. And the reason that the recommendations are the way they are is because you have to look at all the factors that impact those. And part of that is really understanding how it really works in the workplace. And so I experienced that as a young woman entering the workforce and getting raises based on my administrative assistant salary. And so that's why, as an individual, I go out and I try to tell every young girl that it's okay to ask for
you know, proper wage for her work. But we have an opportunity to look at systemic issues here that would actually reduce that disparity for children who don't, for girls and women who don't get access to people who want to empower them. And so that's what this report really says is, you know, as an individual level, we all have a responsibility and accountability, but this is our opportunity to look at systemic issues that actually would bring this up faster. Well, at the same time as empowering young girls and women.
Thank you very much. It's a good note to end on. We are going to close the informational meeting on pay inequity, and we are going to open the informational meeting on the training program at Lynn Benton Community College. And I have two people here, Dr. Greg Hammond and Gary Price. Is there anyone else who should be joining you today? Just two of you. Come on up. Welcome to the House Committee on Business and Labor. I can go in any order. Just please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barton and members of the committee, my name is Greg Hammond. I'm president of Lynn Benton Community College. I have with me Gary Price, who is the lead administrator, director, dean of everything we do in East Lynn County, which includes the Advanced Transportation Technology Center. And so he'll be talking after me also. Greetings to my own representative, Representative Thompson. Thank you, an old friend, Representative Witt. Good to see you. It was probably 5 years ago that that we began to do something that perhaps every community college does, and that is take a look at the employment projections and look at the kinds of jobs that are there and how many there are, and ask, does this support the kind of economic future that we want as a state or as a community? And we concluded no. And we said, if we simply live with the projections that are given us, which are accurate projections, they are what happens if we do nothing other than that. And so I always quote my friend Seth Godin, who says, you know, it's easy to respond, it's easy to react, but if you want to change the future, you have to innovate. You have to actually get ahead of that information and make something different. And what we've done at Lynn Benton is to join with our business community in the belief that we can make the future something different than those projections would indicate. And the product of that is an intentional plan to double the size of all of our career technical programs in the industrial manufacturing area and in the health occupations area. And so, and we are in the process of doing that. I'm grateful for the people I get to work with on my campus, but I'm also grateful for the really forward-thinking businesses that we get to work with who are ready to expand, to add to their workforce, to be vital members of the economy of our area. And they recognize that that doing it together with education is the best way to accomplish that. I think we have in the past frequently thought that perhaps if we have jobs, the educated workforce will follow. Or else we thought, if we create an educated workforce, maybe somebody will bring some jobs around. And I think what we've concluded is the only way to really make that happen is to partner with business and to actually create those jobs and the educated workforce at the same time. And so that is what we're working to do. So over the next 5 years, we will have doubled our automotive technology program, our diesel program, added over road trucking programs. We'll double the size of our welding program, our machine tool technology program, our mechatronics program. We currently have, I believe, 12 health occupations programs, and we intend to expand those into health occupations positions, which do not even exist yet. But we know they're coming. And one of the things I'm always cognizant of is that I'm going to need more and more health care, and probably you will too. And I want to make sure that those people know what they're doing and know how to care for my needs. And part of our future is providing that workforce. So that's our overarching plan. The sort of first step and the one that we're excited to be able to talk about with you today is the Advanced Transportation Technology Center, and I'm going to turn it over to Gary Price to talk about that project and why we and our business community are so excited about it. Thank you.
So good morning. My name is Gary Price. I'm the regional director for our Linn County Extension campuses at Linn-Benton Community College, and that includes the Advanced Transportation Technology Center, which I'm going to share a few details with you today. A lot of people seem to be kind of interested in this. We've got $7 million invested in this project already. It's going to be a $10.6 million project by the time we're done. It sits on 11.03 acres. And we intend to, in that particular building, move our auto technology and heavy equipment diesel and over-the-road trucking programs into this facility for the purpose of upgrading these training programs for our degree-seeking students so that they can develop mastery around all the alternate fuel technology that's now getting into the marketplace, specifically electrics, propane, compressed natural gas. So let me walk you through a few things, and hopefully I'm going to be try to be succinct, and hopefully you'll be somewhat interested as well. So our purpose, that's it. We're meeting industry, workforce, community, and student needs. This is became more than just about our degree-seeking students. There's an economic impact that we are going to be measuring, and there are partners around us that have taken a lot of interest in us, and they've shown that interest by donating money to us. Obviously, the first step is training and education for our degree-seeking students. We want our people to be the most sought-after technicians in the marketplace, and we're going to do that by giving them the type of advanced skills that other people entering the marketplace are not going to have. We are building capability to do fleet conversions. So we will be entering into partnerships with fleet size operators in our region that want to investigate and make the move into alternate fuels. You probably know the DOE, their stated goal is 20% penetration of alternate fuels into the fleets across the state of Oregon. That's going to be a lot of fleet conversions, and if we get there, it's going to require a lot of maintenance and repair technicians. It's just not about selling the technology, and it's about also maintaining and repairing it. Commercial fueling on our site, in order to help with these demonstration projects and these partnerships, we believe that we need to have fueling technology on our site. So we're going to have a commercial size compressed natural gas fueling, propane fueling, fast charger for Nissan Leaf. This will help our partners safely be able to partner with Linn-Benton Community College and explore and experiment with adopting some of these alternate fuels. My friend that owns a 200 trucks in his fleet isn't going to convert to compressed natural gas because Gary Price thinks it's a good idea. He's going to want to be able to investigate the economics of that on his own, and we're going to help him do that. Innovation Center. We believe it's innovative. It's a place on our phase one has already been built. Phase two and three includes an innovation center, which is about 15,000 square foot area where our industry partners are going to be able to come to Linn-Benton Community College. They're going to be able to bring their own trucks and equipment and vehicles there, leave them for a week. They can do their own training. They can partner with my staff to do training. And when this thing is fully up and running, we'll have heavy equipment diesel students in one area, we'll have auto tech students in another area, and we'll have some of our industrial partners doing work in the training center, in the innovation center. We've also been written into a couple of research grants. So some details I gave you already, 11.03 acres. We remodeled an existing 35,000 square foot building. Our auto tech program just started there this fall. This is all new. We bought the building in November. It's up. We took our first students this fall. We moved our second year students in this past winter. Next up is construction of a 15,000 square foot innovation center. It's in design. It's really 99% designed right now. There's a 20,000 square foot heavy equipment diesel, and we're going to add a new program for over the road trucks that we didn't have before. The plan is to significantly increase enrollment, in all of these programs. And this Advanced Transportation Technology Center, in my view, is the first step in Linn-Benton Community College's commitment to an industrial and healthcare economy that exists in Linn County and Benton counties. And that's really what this is about. It's preparing our students to be able to, kind of drive forward our own local economy. So there is just a list of partners that have kind of donated. I put the two in yellow because I thought they were maybe the most interesting to talk about. This site is actually in within the city limits of Lebanon, Oregon, a small community of 15,000 people. The City of Lebanon donated $1.4 million to us through their Urban Renewal District funds. They saw this as an economic development strategy to have a training center such as this in their community. And the Economic Development Administration as well, $1.5 million. And on and on, so far over $7 million. So, degree-seeking students, they'll learn about compressed natural gas, propane, and electrics in our program. Incumbent workers will have a place to come and receive training from us. We are part of an organization that's called NC3, the National Coalition for Certification Centers. So we are also already tapped as a, not just a local training center or regional training center, we're a national training center. We're holding our first trainings there come July. We're going to be providing some 3-day, it's called light duty, compressed natural gas training in March. And the same thing, another 2-day training on fuel system inspection. These trainings will be targeted towards incumbent workers. You know, guys are already working in the industry. Their skills are starting to time out like all of ours do if we don't, reinvest in ourselves. And in the technical areas, I mean, it's very evident if a worker, what they can and can't do. So they really must keep up. Fuel systems conversions is something we're going to be partnering with our community and fleets to work on with them. The PPGA, which is the Pacific Propane Gas Association, has provided us with those brand new vehicles, four what we call light duty vehicles. That's kind of the wheelhouse for propane conversion as kind of a good economic benefit. Clean, green, and when we talk about green at Lynn Benton Community College, we're talking about the kind of green that goes in your pocket. There is a green component as well. One of the things I'm working on an IGA right now. It's not completely done, but we're going to partner with the Benton County Sheriff's Department. They're going to provide us with 20 of their new fleet vehicles, and we're going to convert those to propane. They've done the analysis. They see that it actually can save them money relatively quickly. And all of these alternate fuels adoption strategies are really based on, what's the return on investment. And, it happens, the more miles you put on the vehicle, the faster the return. And fleet partnerships, we'll be just looking at more and more of those as time goes by. Had a meeting with DEQ just the other day, there is a possibility. This is for anybody. I mean, this is not happening yet, but there was a discussion of, the vehicle rehabilitation, particularly large trucks, and using some of these alternate fuels and convert some of these vehicles instead of just put them in a landfill and decommission them, which was the initial come out strategy I think DEQ had. Just buy them, replace them with clean vehicles. Now what do we do with these vehicles? Well, come down to Lynn Benton Community College and we'll put them back on the road and clean. Public fueling, we think this is, it's a critical strategy to get where we want and to be able to partner with fleets in our area. Because if we can't fuel their truck, if we can't, for example, kind of simulate what a trucker can, what happens to him when he goes gets his diesel fuel. If we can't do that with compressed natural gas, we're not. The whole strategy breaks down. We have to be able to do that, or else these fleets just can't partner with us. Eventually, we're not really in it for it to be a fuel distributor. We're just in it to play our role, which is to stimulate the adoption and let people have a place to do demonstration projects and have an education partner. More on fleet vehicle fueling. We're going to have propane, CNG, electric. Some of the research indicates that some of these fleets are converting to alternately fueled vehicles. I've been to a couple of conferences, and I've been listening to the people that are manufacturing the engines. I'm going to these conferences where it's, these large trucking companies that have made the conversions, and they've got big enough staff, they've collected the data, they've done the analysis, and now they're educating the rest of us that, yeah, really, there is money to be saved here. It's not just about being clean. Of course, we know these fleets have to meet EPA standards. That's not going to go away. And alternately fueled vehicles is a great strategy to get there. And my guys would be able to work on them and do the conversions. Clean, green. And so when we got into this, that last bullet, they are cleaner. So the EPA loves it. They are green. A lot of the big companies, Giant Eagle, if you want one to just look up, Giant Eagle, big food distributor out of Pittsburgh. They're saving money. They're putting a lot of money in the bank. And then the U.S. Energy independence kind of strategy is dependent a lot on use of alternate fuels. The Innovation Center, we've talked a little bit about that. We're very excited to get that up and running, open and available to our industry partners. More on the Innovation Center, I have to mention that we've made a huge investment. We've got great partners in this. We have a brand new dynamometer. Dynamometer is a performance testing equipment for automobiles and trucks. And this thing is a $200,000 piece of equipment. Drive Oregon helped us buy it. It's the only one of its kind between Vancouver, Washington, and someplace down in Southern California. Only one of its kind, meaning it can actually do performance testing on electric vehicles. So we've been written into a University Transportation Consortium research project because they wanted access to our toy, our dyno. So that's the type of investment and commitment you have to make in these technical training programs. You know, nobody knows better than Greg how expensive these things are to have and maintain and keep up and running. But our local industry people that work with us closely, they understand that's what it takes, and they help us get there. And Greg mentioned the domino effect. This is the first in a series of kind of financial investments in our community, in our career and technical education programs, like I said, that are going to fuel and maintain and support that healthcare and industrial economy that exists in our area. Thanks. Appreciate it. I think Greg's got some closing comments, too.
Please. Actually, I'd like to open up for any questions you might have.
Absolutely.
That would be better.
Please, we set you up. You know, most of us up here represent community colleges directly, and right. The few of us who do not represent a lot of students who go to a nearby district. And I think I speak for everyone up here when I tell you that we really appreciate everything that you guys do. You have a special place, I think, in the Oregon economy, and indeed in our hearts. I represent Clackamas, and Clackamas is very proud, in particular, of its partnerships that it does in the healthcare industry with various hospitals in terms of that training. And I know Representative Matthews represents Mount Hood, which is renowned for its public safety work. What you guys are doing down there, many of us have heard of before. It's really just great to hear about it. Thank you for what you're doing.
Great.
Any other questions, comments? Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. I guess it sounds pretty exciting. I was wondering, what kind of numbers are we talking about in part-time and full-time students and faculty? Because it seems, looks like it's geared towards a lot of folk, and I'm just trying to understand the impact, and Lebanon's a remarkably small community in the scheme of things.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, it's our students right now. We have 60 students in our auto technology training program. It's a two-year program, so there's 30 first-year students and approximately 30 second-year students. We have some attrition because, like any other education program, some just can't, for whatever reasons, they don't make it. For years, we've had one of my department chairs manages a list of students that wants into the program, and we find ourselves in a position where often a student wants in, there's not enough seats. Now that student is forced to make some choices, wait, take additional courses, and none are the best choice. The best choice is for that student to start in the program if they have an interest. So we are going to be having expanded capability, but we are also changing the programs. I think it's another thing that's really important. We're not just building brick and mortar and rolling over what we did last year and do something new. We are responding to the changing needs of the industry, and we're doing that with our program too. So I don't want to go into all the program changes, but it's pretty significant in the second year. Allows a student to get a job after his first year, walk away with his brand new set of Snap-on tools that we just gave him for completing his maintenance and light repair certificate, about $6,000 worth of hand tools, which, by the way, in the auto industry, no tools, no job. So we're doing things to really, make sure our students can get into the workplace. But that second year, they get to actually, if all works the way we see it, you can keep working and come back to school.
Any additional questions or comments for this panel? Representative Thompson.
Does this kind of project speak to the possibility of moving from regional community colleges to statewide centers of influence? And I'm thinking in terms of what you're doing. We probably don't need to do that at all community colleges, because mm-hmm. you're doing it. You need to right-size you for what the needs are for the state of Oregon, where another community college might specialize in something else and and build a center of excellence around that. Is this an opportunity we should be looking at? Well, we've always kind of looked at community colleges as their regional boundaries, but maybe that's going to become obsolete as we specialize.
Well, Representative Thompson and members of the committee, each community college is a...
Oops. Party foul.
Is there a fine bucket or something?
Yeah, there is. Each community college, you know, uniquely responds to the needs of its community, its district. And while there are commonalities, certainly there are differences. But we also do, and Lynn Benton is one of the schools, not the only school, that does some programming at the state level. A number of our health occupations program are statewide programs in which those students will start their program at those regional community colleges, and then through a combination of on-site work with us and some online work, actually complete their program. And I do think that there are opportunities for specialization depending on the communities we work in. One of the manufacturing communities that is unique to the Lynn Benton area is what we call exotic metals, working in titaniums and things that I can't afford, but is a very rapidly growing industry because they do all for the aerospace industry. And so we're partnering with them, and that's a very expensive business to get into. And so, you know, I think we do see a place for, if you're interested in working in exotic metals market, that we would find ways of making that education accessible statewide. And again, we already do some of that, but I think there are new opportunities as well.
Any further questions, comments for this panel? Seeing none. Gentlemen, thank you for the work you're doing down there and for bringing it to our attention.
Thank you for the
really, it's great to hear about it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the informational meeting. I'm going to pass the gavel over to my able vice chair.
Thank you. And have we opened the Okay, we want to open a public hearing on House Bill 4120, and let's start with Vice Chair Barton, please. Please introduce yourself for the record, and let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues. I will be brief because I think, for the record, I'm Brent Barton. I represent Oregon House District 40. It's my privilege today to talk about a bill. We've discussed it in passing before, and I think most of you actually have signed on as co-sponsors. I will defer on the mechanics of the bill and the reasons for it to subsequent speakers, but I'd like to take a moment and talk about how I became involved and really honor a fallen officer in my district, Officer Lipke. All of you have heard of him. He was a reserve officer who was killed in the line of duty not far from my house, about half a mile. And his death and his service, and I should add that he truly was a hero. There was an active shooter who was seemed to have been in a deranged state, and he actually approached random houses near where this was happening. And so there's not a doubt in my mind that Officer Libke's service actually saved lives of innocent people. And I have never seen a community unify as Oregon City did, and indeed all of Clackamas County, indeed all of Oregon did, in honoring Officer Libke. It was it's certainly the most moving thing I've ever been a part of in public service, and I hope it stays that way. I hope it never gets repeated. In any event, this bill is designed to honor him, as it discovered that there was some benefits that reserve officers, because they were reserve officers and not technically full-time officers, their families were not eligible for. And in this case, it was a scholarship. And that's a loophole that was unintended, and which this bill is designed to close. But again, I really view it as honoring the legacy of Officer Lipke and reserve officers generally. They don't get enough credit. Having said that, I'm happy to answer any questions or defer them to subsequent panelists.
Questions or comments? And incidentally, I'd like to thank you for bringing this bill forward. And as a neighbor, I represent represent the surrounding area. It was amazing to see the community response and frankly, your response as well. It's a hard thing to figure out how you respond, and I think remarkable.
And I'd like to thank you for co-chiefing with me. Appreciate it.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Want to come back and continue? Who do we want to invite next?
Patrick Singh.
Okay, Patrick Singh, please.
Daryl, I don't think, is here, and Kevin Campbell.
Great. Mr. Chair.
Can you run this way? Okay. Gentlemen, thank you for your test, for coming down, and just remember to introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Barton and fellow representatives, thank you for having us here today. My name is Bob Ball, and I'm the Reserve Commander for the Portland Police Bureau. I've been a reserve officer for over 18 years, and just briefly, I wanted to tell you what reserve officers are. They're just ordinary citizens. I know in my command I have mechanics, salespeople, airline pilots. I even have a lobbyist. And they're ordinary people that go through the same process as a paid police officer. They go through the same testing process, a very lengthy training process, and they go out and they serve the community. And they risk their lives. They put themselves in positions of danger. And it's my privilege to command the men and women in Portland. But reserve officers are statewide. The evening that Officer Lipke was shot, I was called to go to the hospital because our EAP team was up helping organize the response. And I saw Mrs. Lipke up in the waiting room, and she was on bed rest because she was pregnant with their baby. And I was a new father myself this year, and overwhelmingly the thing that kept coming back to me was her up there, and I just kept thinking about that baby. And we had brought this idea forward some time ago, and instantly that's the first thing that came to me, is that we really had to get this done, because these reserve officers serve all of our communities and they put their lives on the line. And really, I felt that we as a community needed to give back and honor that service and stand behind that service when something as tragic as this happens. So as Representative Barton said, Officer Lipke is a hero. And I appreciate, I know most of you, if not all of you, are co-sponsors on this bill. And I want to thank you very deeply. From all reserve officers statewide, it means a tremendous amount to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Singh. Usually, I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Counties. That's probably the role you are most familiar with, but I'm also a reserve police officer with the Portland Police Bureau. This year will be my fifth year as a reserve police officer. I've always wanted to be a police officer. I think I've just found out I am a police officer in a lobbyist body, so I love the work that I do here with you as well, and it's a pleasure to be able to bring on bills like this where we can recognize the work that reserves, we have over 1,300 reserves in the state and volunteer firefighters, about 8,000 volunteer firefighters in the state and probably all of your communities as well. So this bill was originally authored in the 2011 session when I worked for Representative Cowan, for those of you who remember her. It was part of a work group on reserve police officers that eventually went on to extend statewide protections to reserves, covering them in certain crimes like assaulting a peace officer and providing false information to a peace officer. It also allowed us to work cross-jurisdictionally by giving us statewide arrest authority as well. This bill didn't make it out because we were focused on the efforts of that larger bill. So we thought it would be an appropriate time to bring it back now and honor Officer Lipke. Officer Lipke was a academy classmate of mine. We went to the Clackamas County Reserve Academy together in 2009. We were split up into two different groups, and he was in the other group, but in the times that we had class together, he was always a very funny guy. You could tell he was hardworking. At that time, he was aspiring to be a full-time police officer, and him and his fellow Oregon City Reserves were working very hard to do that. I was able to catch up with him about 2 years ago when Oregon City Police Reserves worked the Portland Starlight Parade, and we had a chance to catch up, and I asked how things were going, and he said they were going great. Things were going great with his family, or, you know, his wife and them trying to have a family, and also his job. And so he kind of determined he would be a career reserve, like Bob and I are. So I'm glad that you all have decided to bring this bill forward and co-sponsor for those. We have 70 co-sponsors on the bill. For anybody who's not, feel free to sign on. There are 12 statewide organizations that are sponsoring the bill, including the counties, cities, police chiefs, fire chiefs, volunteer firefighters, reserve police officers, union police officers, police survivors. I'm probably missing a few, sheriffs. So we very much value their support and for this bill as well. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions.
So a comment for each of you. First, Reserve Captain Ball, I want to thank you and also the Portland Reserve officers generally for what you do on behalf of reserve officers around the state of Oregon. I think your organization, and frankly, the only department big enough to kind of get that critical mass where you guys can organize. And but for that happening and your leadership there, I just don't know that reserve officers in other smaller jurisdictions would have the voice that they do here. So even though you command just the Portland reserve officers, you lead all of them around the state, and I really appreciate everything you guys have done. And Reserve Officer Singh, you will recall just outside during legislative days when we were talking about getting co-sponsors, you said, I think we can try and go 90 for 90. And I said, listen, man, that's never been done in a short session. It cannot be done. That's something, that's a nicety that can only happen in a long session. And the fact that you guys will all remember him running around, he got 70 in interim days for a February bill. I think that is unprecedented. And it's just why you're a great lobbyist. Thank you for working so hard. You really did us proud. And you guys, I think, honor Officer Lidke by your work here. Having said that, are there any additional comments or questions for this panel? Representative Kennemer.
I just need to point out, Officer Singh, you look remarkably different in this uniform. and thank you for carrying that bill around. It was amazing to reach out. And I think a remarkable way to say thanks for someone who gave their life in protecting us all.
Well said. Any further comments, questions of this panel? Thank you again for your service generally and for the work on this bill, particularly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Two more. I'd like to call up Daryl Fuller. I also have signed up Kevin Campbell. Is he here? It said there, Kevin Campbell, on behalf of the Chief of Police, and the note says, not providing testimony, just indicating our support. So I want to note that for the record.
And Chair, can I note also that you Please. Received testimony from Chief of Police Michael Reese from the City of Portland.
Perfect. Mr. Fuller, please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. This is a short session, so I won't take any more of your time other than to suggest that the Oregon State Sheriff's Association strongly supports the legislation. Happy to cooperate with Patrick from Associated Oregon Counties and the other people that are sponsoring the bill to say this is just an appropriate thing to do at this time, and be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions of Mr. Fuller? Mr. Fuller, thank you for coming
thank
up
you.
And for indicating your support. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4120, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4120. Representative Kennemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 4120 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kennemer moves House Bill 4120 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Any discussion at all on this bill? Again, I want to note, I want to thank the courtesies of the clerk's office staff and everyone for moving this bill so quickly under these circumstances. We're trying to get it to the floor on Thursday of this week. Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bagan?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
It's Representative Holden?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kammer?
Aye.
Chair Barton?
Aye. Motion passes. I will carry the bill, and I think this is a unified bipartisan bill. I'd like to invite my vice chair to co-carry it with me, if you're so inclined.
Thank you.
So we will co-carry that. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4120.
Close the work session.
Work session on House Bill 4120. Thank you, Representative. We're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 4010. Can we summarize the bill, please?
Mr. Chair, committee members, this measure authorizes the Employment Department to make public all decisions of the Employment Appeals Board and applies to all decisions that are made before, on, or after the effective date, declares an emergency effective on passage. I'd like to point out that we had testimony submitted for the record in support from the Oregon Law Center by Sybil Hebb.
Thank you. We have two people signed up to testify today. Please come on up. You're most welcome. Ms. Rostetter, and of course our usual regular here in this committee, Mr. Gersenfeld. Please go ahead in any order. Just introduce yourself for the
okay.
record.
Chair Barton, members of the committee, I'm Susan Rostetter. I'm chair of the Employment Appeals Board, and I'm just going to briefly talk about the background on this bill, why it's needed, and exactly what the bill does. Now, as you're probably aware, the Employment Appeals Board is a quasi-judicial body that's part of the Oregon Employment Department, and we review decisions made by administrative law judges in contested cases regarding unemployment insurance benefits. Now, in 2007, the Employment Appeals Board began publishing our decisions on a department website. In July of 2013, the department stopped publishing the decisions because there were concerns. We were advised that we were not in compliance with the confidentiality requirements imposed by ORS 657555. And that's a law that has very strict confidentiality requirements in regards to any information related to unemployment insurance. There's a number of exceptions, but unfortunately, the Employment Appeals Board decisions are not one of those exceptions. Now, we believe that access to these decisions is important for a whole host of reasons, one of which is public transparency is certainly a critical goal of good government, and we'd like to promote that. Secondly, and most importantly, access to those decisions is a really important tool for employers, claimants, and their representatives to understand how the system works. Most of the individuals who participate in these unemployment insurance hearings are actually not represented by counsel. And without access to the decisions, it's sort of an extra burden on those people to figure out exactly how the system works and whether they do or don't qualify and so forth. Now, since the date on which the Employment Appeals Board decisions, the publication of these decisions was ceased, we have received numerous complaints. Among those complaining are attorneys who represent claimants in the hearings, a representative from the City of Portland Human Resources Department, and then the Administrative Law Task Force, which is a group of legal aid attorneys who typically will represent people in these unemployment hearings. And, of course, you have the testimony from on behalf of some of those attorneys. So what the bill does is to amend ORS 657555 so that the EAB decisions can be released to the public and be available as a public record. And that's pretty much what we're trying to do with the bill. I'd be happy, and by the way, the Employment Department does support the bill, as Mr. Gerstenfeld's presence will indicate, and I would be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Do you wish to add to that, Mr.
Gerstenfeld? Chair Barton, for the record, David Gerstenfeld, Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance at the Employment Department. I really don't have anything to add. We certainly do support this and recognize the value of having these decisions be publicly available.
Thank you. Representative Kenner.
Yes. When we make available a decision, what does that mean?
It is
in terms, because sure. There's a lot of evidence that goes into these decisions, and I'm just wondering, is all of that also then made public record? because Chair we Barton would have health information and lots of other personal items that I...
Vice Chair Kinnemer, no, the record, it's only the decision that is posted on a website that is currently accessible to employees of the Oregon Employment Department, but the information contained in the record, which you are correct, Vice Chair Kinnemer, often includes confidential health information, social security numbers, and other information. That would not be part of the whole of the publication. We are also planning to redact the decisions, redact names and addresses, which and also confidential health information, which sometimes finds its way into the decisions at this time. And there'll be further discussions about any other redaction that may be necessary.
Any further questions for this panel? It looks like you might be getting off easy.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your service. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on this? J.O. Wilson, come on up. Again, members, we are not planning to work this bill today, but I suspect that, barring a surprise, it will be coming to you for work session soon.
Thank you, Chair Barton and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries, and I just wanted to convey that business supports the measure. I got the drumbeat from our attorneys and counsel to get those decisions back online, so we definitely do support.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Wilson? Representative Kinnemer.
I guess that's a little can get them back online. Were they previously online?
Well, it's my understanding that they went dark for a little stretch. Yes.
So apparently, so if I may, these
sorry
things,
not to be up speed.
Not at all. These decisions were traditionally available online and widely accessible. Then I gather perhaps counsel might have realized that might be in violation with current statute, and so they went dark, and this will allow them to go live again. I just recently did my first one of these ever for not my usual line of work, but I'm arguing one in front of the Court of Appeals, and I just don't know how the system could function without these decisions being widely available, for whatever it's worth. Any more questions of Mr. Wilson? Thank you for coming up. We are going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4010. And actually, I'm going to, Representative Witt, would you like, I don't believe you voted on the organizational meeting.
That's correct.
I'm going to reopen the organizational meeting for the purpose of adopting the rules. Again, for the limited purpose of allowing Representative Witt to vote on that. Representative Witt, how do you vote?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Witt votes aye.
Witt votes aye. With that, I'm going to close the organizational meeting. Any further business come before the committee? We are adjourned. Thanks very much, guys. Thank you.